We're back with more Inside the Clubhouse with Bruce Levine and David Haw on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station presented by Bet Rivers Sportsbook.
We've had a good first hour. This was fun. Who needs baseball, right? Bruce, David Haw, Bruce Levine here inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. Time now to go out to our guest hotline sponsored by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book, and that's where we find the senior writer for MLB Pipeline, our good friend Jim Callis. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you guys doing?
We're doing well. You know, hoping for the best with Major League Baseball and the Players Union talking, obviously, this weekend down to the ninth inning, if you will. But as that goes on in the background and as a deadline looms, we do have minor league mini camps on both sides of town out in Arizona. A lot of hope for the future. We just talked to Pete Crow Armstrong, had a good conversation with a Cubs outfield prospect who came over in the Javi Baez trade. I'd like to start there. You know, obviously, he's coming off an injury. Obviously, he's got a long way to go. But what are the reasonable expectations for him this year in terms of his development?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's not going to be a guy who races to the big leagues because he lost that first full season of pro ball with an injury to his mount throwing shoulder. But I may have told you guys this before. At the trade deadline last year, I was talking to an executive who was not with the Cubs or the Mets, who thought that the Mets had made the worst trade of the deadline by giving him up to get Javi Baez and Trevor Williams. The guy just could not believe that they did that for a couple months of Javi Baez. And he liked Javi Baez, but he just thought that was too much of a give. And, you know, there was a time, I'd say the summer before the 2020 draft, when Pete Crow Armstrong was considered the best high school prospect in the draft. And he didn't have a great summer. It wasn't terrible, but he didn't have a great summer. And so that's why he went 19th instead of higher in the draft. But he was one of the best pure hitters in that high school draft class. I think he was probably the best outfield defender in that entire draft. I mean, he can run, and he has really good instincts. And I think, you know, he's a potential gold glover. We just did an all-defense team for the minor leagues, and he was on our all-defense team, you know, obviously based on tools and not performance last year because he didn't play. You know, I think the biggest question is, you know, how much power is he going to have? Is he going to be a 12 to 15 home run guy? Is he going to be more than that? You know, we just don't know. He's a little bit slender, but he can get stronger. He can maybe launch some more balls. And, you know, we didn't really get any chance to see how he's going to do against pro pitching yet, but you know, I think if he just goes out and has a solid year in A-ball somewhere and stays healthy and gets, you know, 500 or so at-bats, then that's a good development year for him.
Jim, when you look at the Chicago White Sox system, they're ranked last among all the teams right now. I guess that's pretty deceiving considering how many really outstanding young players they have on their big league team, how many are under contract for a long period of time. How would you evaluate the White Sox system right now, knowing that they are pretty well fortified at the major league level with young players for a long period of time?
Yeah, no, I think that's the way you look at it. I mean, they're definitely, their farm system's pretty thin right now. They're rebuilding. But look, I mean, what's your farm system supposed to do? It's supposed to improve, you know, help your major league team get talent either via promotions or via trades. And they've done that. I mean, if it was just a few years ago, they had the, you know, number one ranked farm system in baseball. And they do have, I think, I haven't, you know, ranked these, but, like, they do have one of the best situations in the big leagues with a lot of young talent, with a lot of guys under contract and locked up for a while. And the farm system did its job. It's very hard to maintain a top farm system and win at the big league level. I mean, we're seeing the Dodgers do it now. And we saw the Braves do it when they had their long string of, what was it, like 14 consecutive division titles or whatever it was. But usually, once you start to win, the farm system goes down. And really, I mean, that's the way baseball has it set up right now with the CBA. The more you win, the lower your draft picks are. You have smaller bonus pool. You know, you can't really outspend the bonus pool. And it's the same thing internationally. You know, it's not like before where you could just go out and and go nuts on Luis Robert and sign him, you know, and pay a penalty tax. Now you're limited in what you can do. So, yeah, I mean, I think the White Sox would say the same thing. I'm sure they don't think they necessarily have the worst ranked farm system. I know they've been last in just about everybody's rankings recently, but you know, they do have some interesting young guys, but it's not, I don't think they have a lot of immediate help. I think most of the, you know, what we're going to see in the big leagues has gotten there for 2022. But, you know, they have some super interesting young players, and they need them to develop. I mean, the key for them, I think, is going to be developing some homegrown pitching. You know, they've spent a lot of money on some high school pitchers, all of whom struggled last year. And, you know, the hope is that those guys, you know, kind of turn a corner this year and get going. You know, that would be the Jared Kelly, Andrew Dahlquist, Matthew Thompson group.
Jim, a broad question about this work stoppage and how it affects maybe the development of some of these prospects, whether it's on the Cubs roster or the White Sox roster or around baseball, some of the top-rated prospects on the 40-man rosters who cannot, you know, report and cannot improve and cannot develop. How many of the baseball's top young players are being affected in a negative way if this, the longer this goes on?
I got to choose my words carefully, given my employer here. I'd say, you know, I haven't counted them up, but if you look, we haven't done a new top 100 prospects list yet, and we won't until the lockout ends. But our season-ending one from last year has about 30 guys on 40-man rosters. And, you know, I think, you know, I mean, there's, I don't know what the average number of prospects on a 40-man roster is, but let's say it's, you know, 10 or so per team. I mean, that would be 300 guys right there. Maybe that's a little bit light. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, in the short term, yes, it's not great for the development. In the long term, I'm assuming we're going to have a resolution. I don't have any inside information, but you know, sooner rather than later, I don't anticipate we're going to lose, you know, like 2 or 3 months of the season. So I think it's more just kind of put them on hold a little bit. You know, you're seeing, you mentioned it in the intro. I mean, I think most teams are having, you know, it's not even mini camps. Like a lot of teams will have mini camps for prospects before minor league camps open, which is in the next week or so. And this year, I was talking to somebody this week who joked about how they're having a not so mini camp. They had 100, you know, minor leaguers in there because there's no big leaguers in camp. And, you know, they have, you know, big league, I think a lot of the big league coaches are working with prospects. So, I mean, it's not great if you're in a situation where you're on the 40-man roster and you can't, you know, get development time. But, I mean, on the flip side of that, assuming that it gets resolved sometime, you know, either in the next week or some point in March, I mean, it's not like you're going to lose that much in the long run. And I think most of those guys will get sorted out and begin this. You know, if you're going to begin the season in the minor leagues, they'll probably still do that. I mean, this is just wild speculation, but let's say we have a settlement and spring training, you know, spring training's already going to start late. You know, we might see that team send prospects down to their minor league camp and their minor league teams, you know, sooner than they would otherwise, just because spring training's truncated and they want to focus on the guys on the big league team. So I guess at this point, and hopefully I haven't got myself in trouble, I have no inside information, but I think we're going to see, if you have a prospect who's on a 40-man roster who, say, looks like he's going to start the season in Double-A, I'm hoping that we get everything resolved and that those guys will still open the season in Double-A. You know, pitchers, you might have might have to ramp up a little bit longer, but the hitters, I don't think it'll really affect them much at all if we get something settled fairly soon.
That's the voice of Jim Callis from MLB Pipeline, one of the top analysts, if not the top analysts, of draft and minor league players in the game. And Jim, what are your views of international players like Colas and Cespedes for the White Sox, who are, you know, lumped into, you know, your evaluations of minor leaguers and where they're at, but they're professional players that have already played in professional ball in another country, and also one is 23, the other is 24, that's going to be 25. How do you look at them, and how different do you look at them as far as how quickly they can make it or should make it to the major leagues?
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of their own special category because essentially they were professional players in Cuba for a while before they left and wound up making their way to the White Sox. And, you know, it's a lot different evaluating them than it is, say, you know, Christian Hernandez of the Cubs, who signed at age 16 and is their top international prospect. I mean, he has yet to play in the U.S. yet. I mean, it's totally different. I mean, you know, both those guys are interesting. You get some mixed reviews on them when you talk to people outside the White Sox organization. I think we talked about Cespedes last year, and, you know, there was some question. People wondered, you know, how good is the bat really? You know, he had struggled a little bit in the Can-American Association, and people wondered how the bat would play. And to his credit, I think he hit better than most people expected he would have, you know, playing where he played, you know, this year. You know, he didn't control the strike zone particularly well, but I think he hit a little bit better than some of his harsher critics might have thought. You know, Colas, I think, is a little bit less athletic than Cespedes. He might have a little bit more, you know, power when all is said and done, or be, he might be a little bit more advanced at the same age. But, you know, I think they're going to hope that Colas can do the path that Cespedes took. You know, they had to go through some visa issues with Cespedes, but he got to Double A. You know, they got him to the fall league. You know, I think Cespedes, realistically, Bruce, he probably needs a good amount of time in AAA. You know, he didn't really tear up the fall league. You know, he wasn't as effective in Double A as he was in High A. But my guess is he'll start the year in AAA, and Colas will probably start the year in High A. And, you know, hopefully maybe Cespedes is ready to help by the end of the year, and Colas, you know, at some point, you know, in mid-2023.
Wow. Yeah, because you talk to any prospect, as we heard from Cespedes this week, and they will say, well, we're ready. He's ready to come up now sooner rather than later and make a contribution. But, boy, the White Sox are developing a pretty crowded outfield picture there when you're talking about stockpiling guys in the system and guys who might be coming up. But that's a nice problem to have, Jim. And I just wonder, there's so much curiosity about Colas, when he comes, what he looks like, and what exactly he's going to be as a kind of a prospect. Not only how fast he gets there, but what he has to offer.
Yeah, and you just don't know, because these guys have had a layoff. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, they've tampered this down because he's not going to pitch. But, you know, when Colas, you know, a year ago this time, and everybody knew, it was kind of like the same deal with Cespedes, where he was going to have to wait till the next signing period, but everybody knew he was going to sign with the White Sox pretty early on. You have a Cuban mystique to begin with, and on top of that, you know, Colas was the Cuban Ohtani. Well, I mean, now look at what Shohei Ohtani did last year. That was before Ohtani had probably the greatest two-way season in Major League history. I mean, nobody, you know, had the success doing both that Ohtani did. But, like, Colas is, I think he pitched, like, two or three innings his last year in Japan, and he's not going to pitch. But, like, I think that even heightened it, too. You know, I mean, if we were still calling him the Cuban Ohtani, I think White Sox fans would be going out of their mind wondering what this guy might be. And, you know, I think fortunately for Colas, you know, again, he's not going to be a two-way guy. Nobody's calling him the Cuban Ohtani anymore. But, like, the hype would just be out of control because, again, I mean, Ohtani, I mean, that was, I don't even think, without question, the greatest two-way season in Major League history last year.
Jim, when you look at the Chicago Cubs and two guys that have been at the very top of their prospect list in Marquez and in Amaya, we haven't got much information because of the lockout and they're on the 40-man roster. What have you been able to dig up on their recoveries and expectations for them playing and contributing and matriculating to the major leagues here over the next year or so?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty around both those guys. I mean, Maya had Tommy John surgery toward the end of last season. I think that the hope with him is that he's going to be able to maybe come back and DH, you know, maybe, you know, in the middle of the season, the last couple months, but probably it doesn't sound like he's going to do much catching before, say, you know, instructional league or the fall league. So, you know, I mean, just the throwing aspect of it, he's not going to be ready to throw in games for quite a while. And, you know, Marquez is just a huge enigma. I mean, look, we've talked, you know, a million times that for all the great things that Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer did with the Cubs and won a World Series, I mean, their inability to develop pitching has been unbelievable. I mean, you know, frankly, you almost couldn't develop less pitching if you tried. And obviously they've tried, and then they're trying new things now. But Marquez, a couple of years ago, seemed like, okay, you know, this could be their first star homegrown pitcher they developed in more than a decade. And then, you know, we had the pandemic, and he came up and pitched once at the end of the year and didn't throw strikes, which, I mean, I didn't read too much into that. And then last year he got COVID, and then when they were ramping him back up, he had some minor arm injuries, and he just never pitched. So, I mean, we've seen him pitch, you know, one outing in the last 2 years. So, you know, I haven't heard as much on him. You know, a lot of teams, you know, for obvious reasons, are not talking about a lot of guys on the 40-man roster, but they, you know, the hope is that he's healthy and he'll be, you know, full go whenever the lockout ends and spring training gets going. And he's, I think, obviously a key guy. I'm not expecting the Cubs to contend this year, but, like, their return to contention, I think, is going to be really tied into how much their pitching develops with, you know, I mean, I think guys like Caleb Killian will get there before him, but Marquez has a higher ceiling than Caleb Killian. I like Caleb Killian. He's more of a mid-rotation guy. But if you want to dream on Marquez, you know, he's that guy who could pitch, you know, at or near the front of a rotation, and they need him healthy, you know, not just so he could be with B, but, I mean, he needs innings. I mean, he's pitched, you know, literally, I mean, I guess he's probably did some stuff on the side, but in terms of actual official games, he's pitched in one game in the last 2 years.
Another few minutes with Jim Callis, the senior writer for MLB Pipeline here and Inside the Clubhouse with Bruce Levine and David Haw until 11 o'clock. And, Jim, you mentioned Killian, and we heard from him this week. He talked to Matty Lee at the Sun-Times, and sounds like he has spent some time in the Cubs pitch lab. It sounds like he has gone in and they dove in, and they're working with a circle change. They're working with the curveball grip. They're working with a lot of things. He seems like a very committed, cerebral pitcher. He sounds like a guy who is going to help. I wonder, as you point out, maybe sooner rather than later, what is the time frame realistically for a guy like Killian?
Yeah, I think we, I mean, well, I was going to start to say something. I mean, I guess it depends on what the rules affecting service time are going to be, too. I mean, if the Cubs aren't contending, you know, that could play a decision in whether you call him up at midseason or not. I think he's pretty close. He pitched really well in Arizona Fall League, and there wasn't a lot of good pitching down there. He had a terrible first out. Like, he got COVID. A lot of their double-A players got COVID in August last year and had a layoff, and then he went to the Fall League, and I don't think he was quite 100%, like, I mean, he was healthy in terms of COVID, but, like, in terms of having his arm ramped back up and having feel for his pitches. So I think he gave up, like, 6 runs without getting anybody out his first outing down there, and then after that, he dominated. And, you know, he's a guy whose stuff really came on in an instructional league with the Giants at the end of the 2020 season when he didn't pitch because of the COVID shutdown of the minors. You know, that was a good get for the Cubs in the trade. And, you know, he led the minors in strikeout-to-walk ratio last year. You know, and it's a pretty good repertoire. You know, it's a four-pitch mix. I mean, he's working on the, you know, the changeup. I think he scrapped a slider and kind of got with the cutter, but, like, he's got a good fastball that he really commands well and has some carry up in the zone, and he's got a curveball. You know, I think he's definitely the highest floor among all their starting pitching prospects. And I guess when I say that, and then I feel like, oh, man, I'm like, it feels like I'm trashing his ceiling, and I'm not. But I think, you know, he's proven the most of their pitchers. So I think we'll see him first, and then you're hoping, you know, that the lefties, you know, Marquez has got the huge ceiling. DJ Hirsch is a super interesting young guy, too. And then Jordan Wicks, who they got in the draft last year, I think Jordan Wicks will move pretty quickly, too. You know, they need at least a couple of those guys to develop into solid big league starters to get back to contention. Because it's, I mean, they showed even when you have a great lineup, it's hard to just put together a pitching staff of, you know, just by making trades and doing free agency. That's very, very hard.
Jim, we appreciate your time as always. In closing with you, after Stever and Lampert for the White Sox, who can they look to count on in 2022 if they need fortification in that bullpen or rotation? Guys go down with injury. After those two, where do White Sox fans look?
They may have to look to a trade, to be honest. I mean, I think they're probably their next closest guys would be somebody like Jason Billowis, who's pitched a little bit in Double A. You know, he might be one. You know, Emilio Vargas, he's kind of a sleeper you know, more of a finesse righty than an overpowering righty, but, you know, they don't have a lot. I mean, that's the problem with their system right now. You know, they've promoted all these guys to the big leagues, and they've made some trades to supplement. They don't have a lot of guys ready to step in. So, you know, if they need a major addition or just somebody they feel like they can count on, and Stever and Lambert are up to the task, I think they're probably going to have to go the trade route, you know, if they're trying to win this year.
Thanks so much for your time, Jim. Have a great weekend and hope for good news on Monday.
Yeah, I'm hoping. You guys, too, enjoy your weekend, and we'll talk again soon. And I assume next time we talk, the lockout will be over, whenever that is. But I have no great insight on when it'll end, but, man, I'm hoping sooner rather than later.
Thanks, Jim. We all are. Jim Callis, the senior writer for MLB Pipeline. Great insight into the prospects on both sides of town, Bruce. And one last point before we break here I think is interesting. You know, the fact that David Ross is in Mesa and Tony La Russa is in Glendale, these prospects are getting access to the major league staffs that they might not ordinarily have, which I think is not insignificant. And I asked Jim a question about the limitations of guys who are on the 40 who can't report. What about the progress of guys who are now there already in these mini camps, being able to learn from the expertise and benefit from that from major league managers?
It's a wonderful point, David, and it works the other way as well. Just the idea that when these managers and coaches and the major league staff get to their destinations in spring training, they really don't have much time to look at prospects who come in usually the first week of March, when the teams are already well immersed into spring training, and the managers are really intent on trying to figure out who's going to be on that 26-man roster. This gives them an idea of the skill set of these young players and what to follow and the questions to ask during the season as their mind starts working toward the future. So I think it's a huge benefit on both sides.
When will those major league managers actually be coaching major league players? We'll find out the latest in the negotiations between MLB and the Players Union. We'll go down to Florida. Ken Davidoff from the New York Post joins us next inside the clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
If I hadn't given consideration to what it would mean to miss games, I wouldn't be doing my job. Obviously, I pay attention to that. I see missing games as a disastrous outcome for this industry, and we're committed to making an agreement in an effort to avoid that.
Welcome back inside the clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. David Hopper, Bruce Levine, here until 11 o'clock. That was the voice of Rob Manfred talking this winter about the stakes of the negotiations down in Jupiter, Florida, and the disastrous nature of cancellation of some of regular season games. And it's time now to go out to our guest hotline presented by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. And that is where we find Ken Davidoff from the New York Post. Good morning, Ken. How are you?
Hey, good morning, guys. Just want to say Jesse Rogers says hello.
All right. Jesse is the best, doing a great job down there.
Tell him to buy lunch or dinner once in a while when he's
down. Yeah, it would be nice, okay, if Jesse took us all to dinner sometime
tell him to open that wallet.
Dime.
Ken, this morning and it was posted last night, but your report of yesterday's proceedings, you say basically, if you have tickets for opening day, don't get excited quite yet. Take solace, however, in the fact that Major League Baseball players and owners actually took a step forward Friday. How big of a step was it?
It was a small one, David. It was a small one, but it was big only relative to what transpired here the first 4 days of the Jupiter Summit. Because virtually nothing happened in those first 4 days. It was a gigantic waste of time, or so it seemed. So yesterday, at least they made some progress on one front, and to be frank, one of the simpler fronts, but at least it was something.
Kenny, first of all, thanks a lot for coming on. We appreciate it, and enjoying reading all of your stuff from the meetings in your last few days of working for the New York Post, and all the best to you moving forward in your career. I want to ask you about where we are with the competitive balance tax, because to me, everything else is pretty solvable. Yeah, the players need to get more money initially coming in. They need to get their pool. They're going to get that. at some level. But to me, the competitive balance tax is and has always been the key. And we've heard very, very little about that in negotiations. Do you expect that to be a big part of conversations over today, tomorrow, the next day, however long it takes to really start moving that number up to a point where the players can accept a deal?
First of all, thank you for the kind words. It's been a pleasure being your friend and colleague all these years, and we will continue to be friends. To answer your question, Bruce, that's the key to this whole thing. I agree with you 1,000%, the competitive balance tax. And if it's not a big topic these next 3 days, then shame on both sides. Shame on both sides, because the bottom line is the owner's current offer is ridiculous on that matter. There's no way in heck the player should ever accept it. The player's offer, I would not say is ridiculous, but it's high, and there's certainly room for them to go down. So a pox on both houses if they don't tackle the competitive balance tax in these next 3 days.
Ken, I think this may be, maybe it sounds like a dumb question, but it's one that came to mind yesterday. Rob Manfred does fancy himself a deal maker. He shows up Friday, and understandably, it commands most of the attention in the headlines. Why did it take him until Friday to get there to inject himself into the process?
That's a very fair question, David. I can't give you a great answer. Bottom line is Rob Manfred has largely sat out these negotiations from an in-person perspective. Obviously, he's been, you know, very involved in ownership strategies, and apparently has been here most of the week in Florida. He was out of our sight until yesterday. Yesterday was the first time he engaged with anyone on the PA side. It was Tony Clark. I think we all know that Rob has been a galvanizing force for the players. They hate him. They despise him, and they are united in that hatred for him. He's been quite an asset for the players, and it's really a huge indictment of his time as commissioner that's how things are.
You know, some of the agents I've talked to, some of the players I've talked to can believe that the owners are using this year as a litmus test to see if they can start a season later and then use that as precedent for 150 or 154 game season for the future, not just to not pay the players the same amount, but to really do away with a little bit of April, because it's such a drag after opening day in so many markets. What are your thoughts about that type of interpretation and how baseball may move forward with that?
I think that's a very fair interpretation. I think we all know you guys are in Chicago, for crying out loud. Once you get past the glamour and grandeur of opening day, April is a sinkhole. I mean, you know, any player who takes a truth serum is going to admit he doesn't like playing in April. And, you know, even in L.A., it's workable, but it's still, you know, 60 as opposed to 70. So it's suboptimal conditions everywhere. It's a huge issue in general, and I agree with your sources, and people have said the same thing to me, that, yeah, by and large, April is the worst month. It's rough with the postponements, the delays, the low crowds, kids are still in school, and, yeah, there could be a way to figure out a way, and the players have supported the idea of going to 154. Of course, they still want to get paid for 162, but that is something the sport does need to tackle in the long term.
We're visiting with Ken Davidoff from the New York Post here and Inside the Clubhouse. Bruce Levine, David Haw here until 11. And Ken, I don't know what role this plays, if any, but this week we heard from, it was reported down in Atlanta, the Braves have record revenues. I know they have a new ballpark and they're World Series champions and they're coming off a great year. But when their profits exceed $100 million and the owners are negotiating with players, that is one of those things when you have that reality reported. Does that play any role in this process?
I certainly think it can help further unite and galvanize the players. Yeah, so everyone took note of that report yesterday. And, yeah, it certainly does call into question this ownership narrative. Yeah, we're not making as much money as you think. Like, really? All right, here's the Atlanta Braves, the one team with public information. They seem to be doing just fine. So, do I think Tampa Bay Rays are making money hand over fist. I don't, but that's why they have the revenue sharing plan in place to help a team like that. And the bottom line is they're very smart business people who own these teams. And I get there's the ego trip of owning a team, but you know, you don't continue to own a team if it's a loss leader.
Ken, when you look at baseball and how the union is concentrating on getting money for young players paid early, how they're concentrating on getting a bonus system for the top young players, and how we know the superstars of the game are making money in the $30, $40 million now with the Scherzer contract, is the union missing the point when it comes to the middle-class player, and do they risk pushing the middle player, middle range player, the good veteran player that makes $5, $6, $8 million a year out of the game totally because of the fact that the owners may likely instruct their top officials to say, look, if they want young players, give them young players. We're going to pay those young players and the middle range players, we're not going to have the $5, $6, $8 million for them in the future. Could the union possibly be overplaying their hand?
Yeah, yes. And it's interesting, Bruce, because I think the remedy for what you're saying, first of all, I don't think the owners would need to say that to the front of their front office. The front office are pretty smart. They can figure that out for themselves. But I do think what could help that player, you know, the player I was using, a New York guy, for that, to personify that class is Todd Frazier, right? Because Todd Frazier just fell off a cliff financially. You know, he had a big contract with the Reds, then he became a free agent and got a two-year, I think it was $18 million deal with the Mets, if I remember. And he was stunned that he didn't do better. It's like, well, Todd, people can kind of see the end coming with you, you know. And then he followed that up with a tiny contract, and that's pretty much out of baseball. So, and I think what would help that class of player most is a salary floor, which the owners did propose earlier in these talks. It quickly went away because the CBT was ridiculously low. But I think that's a concept that the union should entertain moving forward.
Before we let you go, Ken, so when I brought this show in today, I compared Rob Manfred's role in being brought into the process to a closer. It's a ninth inning. They need him to close this out with a victory for everyone. But in the New York context, is he going to be more Mariano Rivera or Mel Rojas? What do you project in the next couple of days?
David, I reject the concept that he's a closer. He's more like when you're losing 6-2 in the fifth inning and you need someone to come in there and just keep the game alive. That was Rob's role in this thing. Not a mop, but, just keep the game close. You know, we still got a chance here, but, you know, we need to shut them down. So that I think that's who Rob was yesterday, whatever. Whoever you want to use, Ramiro Mendoza for Yankees fans back in the day. That's who I think Rob was.
As you write out the last few days of working at the Post, and I'm hoping you stay in baseball, but whatever you do, I know it's going to be a huge success. Would you prefer that baseball changes the name of their top official to the CEO of MLB rather than commissioner? Because David and I talked earlier in the show about the fact that commissioner doesn't really represent anything like Landis or, the Bart Giamatti's of the world later on in the 80s. It's more polarized than ever.
That's an interesting question, Bruce. I would suggest instead of changing the title, we change the person. And someone who's more of an ambassador for the game. Look, Bud Selig obviously was an owner, but I think now in retrospect with time, like we understood that Bud had, hand with the player. Like the players took him seriously because they knew he had run a team like, Paul Molitor and Robin Yount that would have done anything for him. And I think Manfred lacks that gravitas. You know, he just lacks that street cred. I think that's what the term I was originally going for. So they need someone like that, whether it's another owner or, I remember when Robert Iger was in consideration back in the day, someone like that. I think what Manfred is proving is that it probably, in many cases, doesn't make sense to promote your number two to number one when you're talking about this job in particular. You need someone who brings a little more to the party.
Ken, great job. Best of luck, and thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, guys. Be good.
Ken Davidoff from the New York Post joining us from Jupiter, Florida, and with his thoughts and reporting on between MLB and the Players Union.
He doesn't pull any punches.
No, he does not. He makes some really good points as well. And we will close out inside the clubhouse. I want to talk to you, Bruce, about what we spoke about at Mullinghaw. White Sox prospect, crowded outfield. Where does Oscar Colas, where does Yoki Cespedes, where do they fit in? We'll talk about it next inside the clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
Oscar's on his way. He'll be here shortly. He'll be here in the next week with our staff and our other players that are there. Based on the feedback that I've received from our staff down there, that he's a talent. He's got some confidence about him, can handle the bat, some power, good instincts for the game. But really, when he gets over here, I want him just to be comfortable. He hasn't gone through a season in professional baseball or certainly with the White Sox. So I want him to blend in with his teammates, get to know the staff, understand what we're about as an organization, really drill in the identity of our organization with Oscar.
Welcome back inside the clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio 670 David Hoffman, Levine. That was the voice of Chris Getz. And we heard from the White Sox director of minor leagues earlier this week, Bruce. And we talked about this on Mullinghaw. Okay, real quickly. Oscar Colas on the way. Yoki Cespedes already there. Wants to be part of the major league team in this year. Mike Rodolfo on the 40-man roster. Oh, by the way, so was Andrew Vaughn. So is Gavin Sheets. So is Adam Engel. What's going on in right field? It's a very crowded picture, especially when you're going to insert Chris Bryant or Michael Conforto in that picture. What's going on, Bruce?
You're forgetting about trades, David. And I think the White Sox are one of those teams that have some depth that you're talking about. They might have They might have the depth of right-handed hitting that allows them to make a move or two. And bring in some pitching or an outfielder from another team that we're not looking at right now. I mean, can they make a deal with one of those middle range teams right now who don't necessarily want to load up on veteran players? I mean, can you trade with somebody outside of your division and bring in players that are going to help you solidify your chance to win the World Series? I think that's where the White Sox are at. They're going to have to take a risk. If you traded an Andrew Vaughn for a top-flight starting pitcher or a top-flight right fielder from another team, would it be the end of the world? Everybody thinks he's going to hit, and he's going to hit a lot. But is that the type of move that the White Sox need to really look at, knowing that their window right here for the World Series is over the next two?
Well, your point's well taken, because they have a surplus of prospects at one position. So they got a stockpile, if you will. And they need a strong starting pitcher. They need a second baseman. They need some things that they currently don't have. So when you have as many right field possibilities as I just mentioned, yeah, you want to use them possibly as a trade piece. Which guy do you think is most likely? Is it Vaughn to be dealt? Mike Rodolfo was somebody you mentioned yesterday as a potential throw-in in a trade. How does the list rank if you're talking about most tradable assets?
Look, David, if you want something good, you're going to have to trade something good. That's always been the weakness in myself and other people when we put up trades, or we listen to our great listeners and they say, can we get this for that? And usually the answer is no. It has to hurt you a little bit to be able to move somebody to get someone really good back. And if you traded a guy like Vaughn, and I'm not even saying they're suggesting trading Vaughn, I'm not.
Right.
What I'm saying is there are probably 20 other teams out there that would look at Vaughn and go, man, that's our first baseman for the next 10 years. He's the next Paul Goldschmidt. Okay, that's how you would look at him and try to project him. And I don't know if the White Sox, have the wherewithal that they want to move Vaughn, because they love him a lot too. That's also a fault for Major League front offices, is that they fall in love with their own guys and they don't want to move them.
Everybody does. Fans do. Executives do. And I don't know if I'm doing that as well by saying that, Andrew Vaughn and Gavin Sheets are guys who – you need to appreciate what they accomplished last year and just how good they could possibly be with more seasoning, with more experience, because these guys were both rookies, and it's easy to forget when we don't have the baseball, right, you know, in our face all off season long. That's the only thing I was saying yesterday, yeah, and the point that I think is bears repeating.
If Rick Hahn was sitting here right now and it was off the record, he'd say, are you out of your mind trading Vaughn?
Right.
Jose Abreu is in his walk year now at age 35. Okay. Andrew Vaughn is going to be a spectacular star for us as a first baseman or an outfielder for the next 7-8 years. We're not trading Andrew Vaughn. I think that's the answer you would get. However, when you're looking at trying to win a World Series, does your perspective change? Does your long-term look at your team change? Are you looking to grab that brass ring right now and say, you know what?
Yep.
The Cubs didn't want to trade Gleyber Torres. They didn't want to trade Eloy. They didn't want to trade Cease. They are huge parts of our team and the Yankees team. But guess what? They won a World Series in 2016.
Bruce, I sure hope we're talking about what the White Sox need to do to their roster and what they're able to do next week when we reconvene on Inside the Clubhouse, because that would mean there's an agreement, that would mean there's roster movement, that would mean there's excitement and optimism in the air, which I think is hard to find right now. But, hey, we have until the deadline, and that is Monday.
Sounds good. David, people can follow me on Twitter at MLB Bruce Levine. Also, writing White Sox and Cubs minor leaguers mostly right now on our website at 670thescore.com. Cesar did a great job for us producing as usual. We have other people to thank.
Yes, thank you to PCA, Pete Crow Armstrong, the Cubs outfield prospect, for joining us. Thank you to Jim Callis, the senior writer for MLB Pipeline. And thank you for Ken Davidoff's contributions from the New York Post. This was a fun show, Bruce, and thank you to the listeners and texters and everybody out there in the audience who listened. And most of all, thank you to you, Bruce, and we'll talk to you this week. Mullenhoff, Monday morning, 5 o'clock. We'll be here all week. Hopefully, we'll have a resolution in baseball. Have a great afternoon, everybody. Steve Rosenblum, Mike Esposito next, right here, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.